John, today will be a lab session. The point of today's lab session is to take a function, for example, a Gaussian, and find a constructive representation. That is, we're going to put it into a computer, and then we can do several things with it. For example, we can add functions, subtract them, scale them, maybe take a derivative, calculate the norm of the function, find the discretization error, and get a bit of a training for that. And next week, we can then move on to differential equations, and that will be easier to handle if we have this background out of the way. So today we'll be with Julia. I'm going to code everything live in a Julia notebook. You are welcome to either follow on and stop me if I'm too fast, or you can peruse the Julia notebook that I will surely post, in particular if you remind me after the lecture, if you don't want to type. And I always recommend that you work in pairs anyway to make it easier. So let's begin. Let's delete the output I have here. I'm not cheating. Version info to check whether the kernel is working. That's working. I'm going to use a bit of plotting later on, so let me load the plotting package. I'm using gadfly. What? Using gladfly, huh? So close. Gadfly. And I'm going to plot something. Plot y equals, now let's define some x coordinate, xx equals I over 10 for I in 0 to 10. This is numbers from 0 to 10. And then I'm going to plot x is the x coordinate, y is sine of 2 pi times x for x in xs. And geom.line to connect the points with lines. And there we have our sine function here. And you see it's kind of jagged because we have a discretization error. Of course, that's the point of what we want to do today. Actually, I like exponential functions better. Let's use a Gaussian here. Exponential of x minus 0.6 squared. There's a minus sign missing here. Oh, we need to divide that by something. Now we need to multiply, right? Let's add 10 times. 20 times is better. 30. Yeah, that kind of looks nice. Maybe 40. Yeah, why not? Actually, let me plot the thing with 1,000 points so that we have something smooth here. That's the function I want to approximate later on. And then we can check the discretization error. On Monday, I presented two ways to discretize something. A spectral method, where we expand something in terms of analytic basis functions, for example, Legendre functions, and finite differences, where we expand everything into these hat functions that I produced. And I'm going to present something with finite differences here. If you don't like that, you can make the same exercises with Legendre functions. So, those of you who are typing, yes?
If I have something coming up saying plot not defined.
It's the using gadfly that you have to do, and then you get that.
Oh, yeah, I spelled it wrong.
And if you don't have gadfly installed, then you have to do this add gadfly as well, which is a bit slow, but I did that earlier. You have to do that only once in your Junior install.
And it says pre-compiling, is that okay?
Yes, that just means you have to wait a minute.
Okay, thank you.
That is so slow. Okay, let's begin. If you want to, what we want to do is take this exponential functions, this Gaussian function, and sample it at a few points to find out how to represent it in terms of finite difference discretization. And a typical beginner's mistake would be to start right away with coding up such a function. And the problem with that is that if the function gets longer, you end up with one large, gigantic function that does everything that you need. And then it's difficult to find errors, difficult to get it correct or to modify it later. So it's typically easier to split the problem up into a few parts. And here, a nice small thing are the basis functions, the finite difference basis functions. I don't know whether you remember them. Let me just sketch them. they looked like that. There was these hat functions with the point I, I plus 1, I minus 1. We for sure are going to use them to calculate a function in the end. So instead of beginning with discretizing a function, I'm just going to implement how these basis functions look like, and then I have a small function, and then we can continue to test that. So let me see how I m code markdown. So I'm going to implement the basis functions. So I'm going to define that. And now, please read the screen and correct me if I make an error. So function, let's call it hat. This function takes two arguments. The first argument I is the what basis function I want to have. And the second argument is n, the total number of basis functions I want to use. And the first thing I'm going to do in this function is to check whether the arguments are correct. There's this assert statement in Julian with the at sign in the beginning, implemented as a macro. So you check something, everything's okay, the assert function does nothing. And if there's an error, it aborts the code and tells you exactly where it aborted the code. That's quite convenient. So we check whether 0 is less than equals or I, which should be less than n. If I have n functions, then number 0 to n minus 1. Next, I need the spacing between the grid points. That was the spacing that I called h last time. That is this one here. So let's calculate it. H equals 1 over n minus 1. And the minus 1 is correct. If I have 10 points, then the points go from 0 to 1. But that means I have only 9 spacings in between. So the grid spacing h is then 1 over 9, not 1 over 10. So h is 1 over n minus 1. And I want to find out, I want to calculate this point. So let me call this coordinate here xi, xi plus 1, xi minus 1. So then I have xi equals h times I. There's an xi minus 1, which is h times I minus 1, xi plus 1. Okay. Is it so far clear how I'm calculating these quantities? No one of you is complaining. Either it's trivial or it's completely over your head. So this is xi, xi plus 1. You can't read that. I'm writing it down anyway. And I think I defined this function on the blackboard last time. So now we need to have a case distinction. Here on the left, the function is 0. Here it has a positive slope, a negative slope, and here it is 0 again. So there's going to be a skate of if statements. Oh, okay, I made an error in that function. Of course, the function also needs to take x as an argument where I want to evaluate it. X has type t. If f is less than or equals xi minus 1, then the result is 0. And here I added x colon colon t. That means x has type t. And I'm returning a result of type t as well. If you don't do that, that's not terribly important. But in terms of efficiency later on, that helps because then the function always has the same return type. Else, if x is less than xi, then we are in this case here. And then I'm calculating this function here, this linear function here. The slope is 1 over h. And so I'm subtracting xi minus 1 and then using that slope, that is x minus xi minus 1 divided by h. Else if x less than equals xi plus 1, return x minus xi plus 1. One of them needs to have a negative slope, right? There's an error here. I can't see it at the moment. but I'm sure you can help me out here. That is the function I have defined. And since I have the plot command, I can just plot it. I defined x as earlier, y is equals hat of which one? That's plot number 5, 5, 11, x for x in x as. And then we see the result. What is, why not that? Oh, it's just y. Okay, that's not what I want. There's a minus sign missing here. Let's add the minus sign here. That is the function. That we're getting. Okay, I'm looking for some feedback from you now. What are you all doing? Are you copying the code? Yeah. Proofreading the code? Okay. Since you're copying the code, I'm going to leave it on the screen. But otherwise, I want to calculate the integral over that function. Can you all see the screen? Should I make it a bit larger?
A little bit larger.
Okay. Does that help? Or one more step?
Perfect, thank you. Can you explain the T thing again?
The T thing, yes. I like to program in a way that is generic with respect to types. Most people wouldn't care. They would just say, if you have a real number, you represent it as a double precision number, so use double precision everywhere. But I don't want to restrict myself, so I'm call it T. This is now a generic function. T can be any type, double precision, single precision, or extended precision. So I say X has the type T. I need to declare type, tear T. So this is where T is what you add in Julia. And you probably can also say that t must be a number or something. And then this n minus 1 is an integer. N is an integer, n minus 1 is an integer. And that t of then converts it to the same type. So that then this division here is calculated. I mean, the result might not be exact. It's calculated for the corresponding type. So if I want to calculate these things with 80 digits of accuracy, I can do that.
Could you explain the assert?
Pardon? The assert? So assert is a macro. It's written at assert, and afterwards is a condition that's either true or false. If it's true, nothing happens. And if it's false, the code will abort with an error message telling exactly where the error was. And if you have certain conditions, internal consistency conditions that need to be checked, it's nice to just put assert statements in there. Then you need to don't need to worry about it. You don't need to write if statements and output something to the screen or something. It's just assert. It's really quick. There's probably also a way to disable them later on if you care about performance. But if you make a mistake, the code will tell you about that. So for example, down here, I set n to 11, 11 points. And I want the fifth point if I'm looking for the 50th point. Sorry, the 50th collocation function, that doesn't make sense, right? That they need to be between 0 and 10, then I get an error. The assertion error stack trace, and here, input field 48, line number 2 of the function, and so on. This is exactly where the assert statement is. And then you can go there and, I mean, fix the problem. Have you typed the function?
I can ask another question?
Please do.
Is there a way of commenting within the code?
Yes, there is. It's just this hash character that you do.
Okay.
obviously, if you have a really large application and you want to make it usable by people who don't know anything about the code, then assert statements are not the way to go, because it just points you to the line where something is. So you need to be able to read the code to understand the error message. But for code development, it's incredibly useful. Do you have a question?
Yeah, can you add like a error message to this sort of thing with your own?
To assert? No, you can't do that. What you can do is to use an if statement instead, and then you can raise an exception, or there's probably a function called addError or something that you can call. And then you have your own message. Okay. Since you're typing, I can also show you how you document something in Julia. There's a thing called a documentation string. If you write a string just in front of a declaration, this becomes the documentation for the respective function. Let's write it like that. And if I then write question mark hat, then I get that output here. So this line here, basis function hat blah blah, is exactly what I wrote up here. I guess that's not really useful here because I didn't write anything long here, but I could have written a better documentation. And if this wasn't a tutorial, but if I'd write a real code, I'd add better documentation here. Okay, are you done? Should I move on to the next thing? I'm plotting the basis function, and if I look at the first basis function, this just falls off like that, and the last basis function, of course, increases like that. So after we have the basis function, the next thing that I want to introduce is how how functions are going to be represented. I mentioned yesterday that we are projecting our function, or we approximate our functions by basis functions, and we have the respective coefficients. So the internal representation will be just the vector of coefficients, internally represented in Julia, of course, as an array. So in principle, a function is nothing more than an array of numbers. The problem with that approach is that there are many things that are represented as an array. And in mathematics, you have different kinds of vector spaces. And if you take one vector from an eight-dimensional vector space and another vector from another eight-dimensional vector space, you wouldn't want to add them. That doesn't make sense. But if you just use arrays in a programming language, you can add everything together. The way to prevent people from doing that accidentally is by introducing types. And then you have different types, and then you cannot accidentally add things together. So here I want to introduce a new type, the type for a discretization, and that prevents this kind of problem. Of course, you don't have to do that. If you just want to quick and dirty calculate something, you probably don't do that, but that makes it in the end more difficult to find an error. So let's go on. Discrete functions. Let's call it fun. Why not? Function should be fun. The type t. T is the type of the function, double precision, for example. And here we have the coefficients, which is just the vector of type t. And this is internally as efficient as just using a vector. So this is as efficient as any Fortran or NumPy code, but you can't accidentally do something with it. Now, next I wanted to define the function that takes as input a continuous function, and then samples that function and produces a discrete function as output. So this is function, let's call it sample. It takes as input a continuous function, call it f, and it takes the number of collocation points that we want to use, Yep, let's do it like that. I hope it works out. And let's do that. Co f's, we define it as an, let's steal some code from up here where we look at the grid spacing and so on. H is the grid spacing, let's calculate that. We're going to need that. So I'm going to use an create an array with n elements that is going to be some expression here for I in 0 to n minus 1. Yes?
So when you have this t very
low. Oh, that t does not work. Yes. Aha, very good. Oof. Okay. Yeah, I need to find out what type the function should have. Is that a type of? Is that the thing? Type 4.0? No. Type of 4.0? Yes, yes, that's the thing. So I'm just calculating the type that one should use. I call the function f at 0. That's something, but why not? And it returns a result. And I'm just looking at the type of the result. And that is t. And then we know the type t. And this syntax, t in square brackets, then creates an array of type t. And then we have f of h times I, which are the coordinates. And then we return a function that just wraps the coefficients. Okay, let's see whether Julia accepts that. Okay, and let me try to call it. Let's sample a simple function. A simple function would be the function that is, for example, always 1. X goes to 1 is a function that is always 1. And let's sample it at 5 points. And the result is a function, it's an integer function, okay, let's say 1.0 here, and all the coefficients are 1. That seems correct. Or let's have a function x goes to x squared. Inexact error. Oh man, what? Oof. Yeah, I think I was too fancy here with this. Sorry. I changed my function, and now, yeah, I'm unsure whether that's actually a good idea, whether I'm making things too complicated by explicitly passing the type of the function that I want to create. Do you want to deal with that, or should I just cut through it and just use double position everywhere? Show of hands. I all scared you into thinking that I'm always doing the right thing. Yes, victory. Okay. Okay, now I'm going to delete that. If you're interested in doing it the right way, then you can. Just calling it float 64 here. Okay. Okay. While I'm doing that, are you familiar with the lambda syntax in Julia, where you create local functions? For example, here x goes to x squared. This is an anonymous function that doesn't have a name. It just maps every x to x squared. In Mathematica, you would use the hash sign and the ampersand for that. So the Mathematica syntax for that would be hash squared ampersand or something. So let's define a function here. Gaussian, let's just call it g of x equals exponential minus 40 times x minus 0.6 squared. I think that's the function I used above here, right? G is a function, and let's discretize this function. Let's call it G11. Let's call it, the coefficients G11 coefs equals sample G for 11 grid points. You look a bit skeptical.
No, I just can't get the sample working.
Pardon? You can't get the sample working. Okay, that's the sample function. I changed it 4 times. That's the problem with live coding, that it's a.
So now, I call the sample 2. So
on, it's the round parentheses. When it comes to arrays, then it's the square brackets. And when it comes to types, then you use the curly braces. So for example, function and the argument type that we have here is load 64. That's the curly braces. That's just the function call that creates the corresponding object. So coefs is passed in with round parentheses. And here we're creating an array. So that's the square brackets here. Yeah, the error messages are apparently not very good because Julia got confused of what you wanted to do. Yes?
When you create the fun scripts, do you have to like names of the things you pass in have to match the fields, or is it like the order?
You have to pass them in the right order. The names do not matter at all. I could have called this just C or nothing, or I could have just copied this expression here and put it in here directly. So the names don't matter.
So if your struct had like 20 things in it,
you have to pass in 20 things. Yes, there are 2 ways out of that. First, instead of having 20 things, you can define some other auxiliary types that it's only 4 things with their more corresponding subtypes. Or you can define your custom constructor and then pass things in. And Julia also has named arguments. So if you define your own custom constructor, you can have named arguments, and then you can name the arguments instead of using just relying on the argument order. So the argument order makes sense for 2 or 3, maybe 5 arguments, but then it gets confusing. So we have the sample function. I defined the Gaussian that we plotted above. Yes?
In your function of sample, you have h equals to 1 minus divided by n minus 1.
Yes.
Or integer, how h knows this is a float.
Ah. The division operator in Julia is special. Because generally you can't divide integers and expect an integer result. So if you divide integers, you get a float 64 result. That's a special built-in rule. And other languages do it different. For example, in the old Python, Python 2, it would produce an integer result and round down. That's confusing. And I think in the new Python, it also does the float 64 thing.
0 to 10.
So we have this Gaussian. And then we sample it at 11 points, and then we get this construct here. And as expected, it's just a bunch of numbers. And if you solve a real problem, you collide black holes. Of course, you get millions or billions of numbers out, and you don't know what happens. So what I'm going to do now, I'm going to write the function that reconstructs a function from the coefficients. So this function takes as input a fun struct, the array of coefficients, and produces as output a new function that can be evaluated. So let's call it interpolate. Oh no, interpolation sounds so low level. I want a better name. Reconstruct. What would be a good name? Evaluate, right? Let's call it evaluate. So the input is the coefficients. Let's call them f again, why not? This is fun of type t, and x, where we want to evaluate it. And what I want to do first, we need to find out how many coefficients there were used. we can look at that. N equals f dot coefs. There's a length function in Julia that gives you the length of an array. So we look at the array that is part of the coefficients, and f dot coefs gives us the coefficient array. You look up here, the definition coefs was that vector that we have. And then the actual function value, of course, is just the sum of all the basis functions multiplied with the corresponding coefficients. So should we do it directly? Let's see whether it works with the sum expression. We have sum of f dot coefs at I times the basis function, I called it hat, right? Hat I comma n comma x for I in 0 to n minus 1. And that doesn't work because Julia array elements starting from 1, so I need to subtract 1 here. Okay. Before I explain that to you, I want to check whether it's correct. So let me plot that thing. Plot, evaluate, actually G11 x does that work? Plot G. Pardon?
Length is spelt.
Thank you.
It was actually good.
It's still green. Oh, man. I thought if the color changes, like in Mathematica, you don't make that. And okay, yeah. X is XS. Y is G. Cross my fingers. Bounds error. Oh, I need to write I plus 1 here. Yeah, that looks good, right? Clearly a Gaussian. Well, that's the right shape. There you go. So we have the sample function, and so let's look at the evaluation function. The complicated thing in the evaluation function is that I numbered my points, my collocation points, starting from 0 to n minus 1. Whereas Julia, the language, likes to number array elements from 1 to n, not 0 to n minus 1. So in hindsight, maybe I should have used a different convention for numbering these points. Maybe I should have started at 1 and going to n. I'm not going to change that because I'm halfway through the tutorial. But I mean, these details then matter to make a code slightly easier to understand. Now we have this evaluation function. It takes as input the coefficients and the point, calculate the length, and then sum just calculates a sum. And inside the sum, I loop over all my collocation points, I from 0 to n minus 1. And this expression here is evaluated for each value of I, and then all the results are added together. It's just the ith coefficient. I need to write I plus 1 because of Julia, and then evaluate the hat function here. That is the ith hat function. There are n basis functions overall, and I evaluate it at x. You look skeptical. You have an error, okay.
Yeah.
I'm glad that at least you speak up and you have an error. It's much worse if people have problems and don't even speak up. There was one argument called f, and f is a real function, a Julia function that can be evaluated at every point, but we can't, I mean, we don't know much else about it. And in the evaluation function, there's also a thing called f, but that's not a Julia function. This is one of our fun objects. And maybe I should have used different names for these arguments. And if you have one of these fun objects, then you can get the coefficients and look at the length. But for the Julia functions, obviously, that's not possible. Yep.
So when you defined fun, and you're saying you're defining a new type of structure, but then you talked about coefficients in it, which we hadn't even defined yet. So. Do you mean every time you hit fun, are you just saying the whatever I've called coefficients are going to be a vector?
So whenever I write fun,
yeah,
or fun of t, then I get, oh, great. Then I get a thing that has one element called coefs, and that is actually a vector, a one-dimensional array of t's.
Mm. Okay, so whatever you put in there, it's going to start calling it coefs, and it's going to make it a vector.
You have to pass in a vector. If you pass in something else, it would not work. So if I call fun float 64 of hello, that would not work out.
I'm more talking about the use of the word coefs, coefficients.
Oh, if I call it like this and then passing something in, 1, 2, 3,
yeah,
then this 1, 2, 3 array is going to be the coefficients. So there's a function called dump. Let me call dump of it. That gives me the internal contents. And then it says what you're talking about is a fun float 64. And the content of fun is a thing called coefficients. And that thing called coefficients is an array of type float 64. And that array has three elements. And it's a one-dimensional array because there's only 1, 3. And these are the elements of the array.
Sorry, I was asking. Thank you.
Yeah. In Mathematica, there's a thing called full form, I guess, or similar. And when you pass that to it, it gives you a lot of internal details of how things are actually defined. And then that's a similar thing that is called dump in Julia. So this was with 11 points. Of course, we can do it with a different number of points as well. And we hope that the approximation gets better. So let me call a G21 here. Oh, what? No, sorry. I need to do this one first, my G11 coefficients. Let me define the G21 coefficients by sampling it at 21 points. And then I have the G21 function. And then I can plot that one as well. And you see it looks a bit better already than the Gaussian. Now, of course, I can play that game and eyeball the difference, but that's not really satisfying. But I want to have actually a handle on how good the approximation is, how good the error is. And for that, we need to do two things. We need to be able to integrate over a function, and that in the end allows us to calculate a norm. So if we want to find out the error, we have two different approximations, say G11 and G21. We're going to subtract them from each other, and then taking the absolute value squared, and then we're going to integrate over that, and that is then a measure for the error, for the discretization error. And then we can get a hard number and see how the error is, and then we can plot the error versus the number of grid points. So that's going to be the topic of the second half of the tutorial. Before that, I want to make a short break and ask, are you all up to speed so far? Okay, so let's define a function that allows us to integrate a function. I called it quadrature last time, because we're not looking for a definite integral or something. And function quad what? Yep, don't need that. Yep.
So when I plot that function, it doesn't get any better because xs, then we have to redefine xs.
Oh, how did you set XS?
It was 1 to 10.
Ah, yes, no, you need to set it to something else. I think I set it, I hope I set it to 1 to 100 or something up there. Sorry, scrolling up. I set it to 1 to 1,000, yes. So you want to have something much larger.
Yeah.
n equals length f dot coefs, h equals 1 over n minus 1. If you recall from Monday's lecture, I had a definition written down here, how to evaluate, how to integrate over function. If you want to integrate over function, an integral is linear. So since we have decomposed our function into a sum of basis functions, what we need to do is we just need to add up the integrals over the various basis functions. And it so happens that the integral over this basis function is just h, because the height is 1, and the width down here is 2h. So since it's a triangle, the over integral is 1. And at the boundary, the basis functions just have half the width, because the other half would be outside. So at the boundary, the integral over a basis function is just h over 2. So I'm now implementing that logic here. I have this quadrature function. First, I obtain the number of coefficients. Then I calculate the grid spacing. Grid spacing. And then, since the loop is a bit more complicated, I'm not using the sum function to sum over something, but rather I'm writing an explicit loop. That's another common technique. I initialize a variable s to 0, and then I loop over all the points, only to s to n minus 1. And in each loop iteration, I add something to S, and the result in the end is S. Now, first I calculate the weight for each of these basis functions. If it's basis function number 0 or basis function number n minus 1, then the weight is 1 half. Otherwise, the weight is 1 times h. There's a big set of parentheses here. And then the contribution to the sum is h times, no, nonsense. Yeah. Is w times the coefficients.
So if it's I equals to 0, then it's t, right? Otherwise, if it's I. So what is the weight? I'm confused with the user symbols, like the question mark.
Okay, yeah. Let me add it differently. If I equals 0, this is an or. I equals n minus 1, weight equals 0.5, else
okay.
W equals 1. The same thing. And I also pulled out the h. Now I multiply w times h. It's easier to understand. Yeah, Julia allows a rather compact notation. And if you're familiar with that, it's obviously very useful. But it's also confusing. So stop me if I'm using that. Hey, we can add comments. I'm getting confused now, didn't I call it? Oh, it's the coefficients, okay. Let me recap again. What this quadrature routine allows us, it allows us to integrate a function, and this allows us to calculate a norm. We calculate the difference between two functions, and then the absolute value squared of the coefficients, and then we calculate the integral. This gives us the L2 norm, and thus we can calculate the error, the difference between two different discretizations. So if you're working with discrete functions, there's obviously lots of details to get right and lots of errors to be made. It's very important that there are also functions that allow you to analyze the result. For example, plotting is interesting, but you also want to be able to get a rather concrete handle onto something. For example, calculating a norm, checking whether something is zero, etc. Are you finished typing this?
So what is the norm?
We don't have a norm yet. This is just the integral over something.
Okay.
If we want to calculate a norm, then we first need to calculate the absolute value squared of something. So for example, at the moment, if the function was negative, it would subtract from the result. That's not a norm yet. And also just calculating the norm of one function isn't really interesting. We want to calculate the norm of the difference of two functions. And then if they're close together, the difference would be small. And then this allows us to look at the accuracy of something. So in the end, we have the G11 and the G21, and we are going to calculate the difference between these, or the norm of the difference. And then we can go to G41, G81, and so on. And we hope, if things converge, then the difference must become smaller and smaller. And then we can plot that difference and see how fast it tends to zero. And Monday I claimed we have a second order convergence. That is, I claim that the error decreases as h squared. And that's something we can then read off from the plot, or we can match something to the plot. Okay, I assume you've finished implementing this function. So let's define a norm then. A two norm. The L2 norm of a function so we can calculate the integral over a function, but now we need to calculate the absolute value squared. An absolute value squared, that's not a linear operation, that's a nonlinear operation. And I mentioned on Monday that the position basis, such as for the finite differencing approximation that we're using, is convenient because we can apply nonlinear functions pointwise. So we're going to do that. You're going to take the coefficients, you're pointwise going to calculate the absolute value squared, and then we have a new function which is an approximation of the absolute value squared of the old one, and then we can integrate that. So we have, let's call it coefs abs 2 as the coefficients absolute value squared is f dot coefs. And then we want to calculate absolute value squared. So abs y squared for y in, let's call it c, right? I called coefficient c. Then we have the new coefficients. Yes. Then we can create a new function for that. 1t of coefs abs 2. And then we can integrate that. We have quad function for that. And yeah, let's also calculate this, to take the square root of that, because then the norm has the same dimension of the function. Let's see whether that works. Does it sound good? Similar about both functions. I have no idea whether it's correct. Does one of you want to fire up a Mathematica and then put the Gaussian in there and see whether the number is correct? So what I would do now, if this was a real project, I would create a few test cases. I would look at a few functions, for example, a constant function or a linear function or a parabola, and check whether the norms have the expected values. And the norm also needs to have certain properties. For example, the norm of a function that is zero everywhere must be zero. Or if I multiply a function by three, then the norm must be three times as large. There must be a triangle inequality and so on. I'd write a few test cases for that. Here I'm not going to do that because I'm constrained by time. Okay, I didn't mention it before, but functions form a vector space. So vectors can be added and scaled. And to make that simpler, I'm going to define a few function where we have a type. So I'm going to scroll up where we defined the fun type. And I'm going to define addition, subtraction, and multiplication for functions, multiplication with a scalar. I think this is base dot colon plus. See whether it works. Works, right? Seems good. And the same for subtracting functions. This is me being fancy. The base dot colon plus is how you add a new method to the addition method that Julia has built in. You might not remember the syntax, but if you don't, the Julia manual tells you how to do that. And what this function does is input takes two functions. Then we are taking two coefficient arrays. Then we have two arrays. Arrays can be added. We're just calling the Julia add function for the arrays. And then we put it back into one of our function structure. And this is how we can add functions. And subtracting works correspondingly, colon minus, and minus to subtract the arrays here. This is an additional overhead that I have to do because I created my own fun type. If I hadn't done that, if I were just working with regular arrays, then I could just add and subtract regular arrays because Julia supports that already. This is the penalty, the price I pay for using fancy types that might make things easier. In a simple tutorial such as today, you don't see the benefit from defining your own types. I want to show it anyway. In a larger project, it might be useful to do that. Okay. What I want to do now is I want to calculate the difference between the G11 and the G22 functions. And there's one more complication there. If you remember, I'm scrolling around. I'm looking for the definitions. Yeah, of course, G11 was sampled at 11 points. G22 was sampled at 22 points. And of course, I cannot just add and subtract these functions because the discrete functions live in different vector spaces. One of them has 11 points, the others have 22 points, so you can't just add and subtract them. So what you need to do is you need to take that function that is sampled at 11 points. I'm going to reconstruct it at the continuum. I'm going to sample that at 21 points, and then I have two functions sampled at 21 points, and I can subtract them from each other. Is that clear, what I'm going to do?
Could you not, so say, have 10 points and then 20, and then take every two values on your 20, and then they would be the same?
Yes, except you need to do it with 11 and 22. Because of the boundary points. Can you see the blackboard here or not?
Yeah.
So let's make it with a smaller number of points. If I have 3 points here, it looks like this. And if I want to have twice as many points than 3, I want to kind of subdivide everything, then I'm going to end up with 5 points here. So this is 3 and this is 5. So what I could do is just take the function that is sampled at 5 points and drop every second point, and then have something that sampled at 3 points. But if I'm doing that, then I might have sampled at 3 points right away, because then I'm having the more accurate function at 5 points, I'm projecting it back onto the function that has 3 points, and then I don't see in how far the 5-point function is better, because all the improvement has been projected out. If you perform a more complicated calculation, for example, you solve a partial differential equation in between, then your approach would work. But since we're just discretizing or something, what we need to do is we need to take this function that is whatever, sampled at 3 points, and then sample it at 5 points, and then in the higher vector space, you need to calculate the difference. Let me add a new section in here. Comparing resolutions. So I have this G11 function, and I'm going to sample that at 22 points. Let's call it G11 22 coefs equals sample G11, 21. And I mean, I'm a bit confused now at the end of the tutorial. If I make mistakes, please catch me. That seems good. And what are we going to do now? We're going to subtract them, T21, G11, 21 coefs minus G21 coefs. That works. And then we calculate the L2 norm. I called it L2 norm of the difference. It is this number. Maybe you should plot it first before I calculate something. How does this work, comma x? Plot x equals xs, comma y equals. This is the difference. Looks good. Looks kind of good. If you look at the y-axis, the difference is about 0.05 or something. And if you look at the actual plots of the functions earlier and compare this function with that function, the difference could be approximately 0.05. So that's a plausible result that we're getting here. And what you also see is that the difference between function is very noisy, it's very jagged, there's lots of up and down in these functions. And that is to be expected, because the difference between these two discretizations, I mean, they don't differ in the long wavelength number. They differ near the cutoff that we introduced in the short wavelength numbers. So this difference has a lot of high frequency noise built in. Okay. Let me take it one step further. I'm scrolling up, looking where I defined the G21 functions. Let me define it also for 41. Looks even smoother, of course. And then let's plot the difference there as well. So what I did now, without much speaking, is taking the Gaussian, sampling it at 41 points, taking the sample at 21 points, resampling that at 41 points, and calculating the difference. Yes?
Yeah, I'm having troubles computing the difference.
Pardon?
Having troubles computing the difference.
Okay, yes. And this is not really difficult, but since it's the first module, this is the first homework. The homework for this differential equation module has you then solve the partial differential equation, which will be covered next week.
Oh. Can I just come up a bit?
What is it due to?
The homework from the previous module is due this week. If you're busy, I'm happy to give extensions, but the previous module was finished 2 weeks ago, and I think 2 weeks after a module is a good time. You can have an extension. I mean, the point is not to put you in time pressure. The point is to actually make you do that. And the homework for this module, which ends next week, is then due 2 weeks after that.
So was it on Friday?
Yes, this week, Friday. If you can't get to it, send me an email, or stop by my office, anything like that. So that's all easy. OK. Sorry, you wanted me to scroll up? Now this convergence test, I mean, it looks a bit fancy and complicated, is of course really complicated if you don't, sorry, really important if you don't know anything about the solution. So if you solve a partial differential equation with some right-hand side and some boundary condition, and you don't know what to expect, then it's important to actually test whether you're in the convergence regime or not. And then what you do is you perform the same calculation twice with different resolutions, and then you can compare them. Do you have questions? Okay, let me just try to be fancy. Take it one step further. Should really automate that.
Typo here.
I have a typo?
Yeah.
Thank you. Of course, I have a typo. Oh, it's Gamble. Good. Let's see whether that works. Yeah. So now we're using 400 points instead of 40 points. There's of course quite a bit more. And you see the error went down to 10 to the minus 5. Not that impressive, right? That's just 4 digits of accuracy. If we had used the spectral method with 40 points, then we would already be at floating point round of a 10 to the minus 15. But with finite differencing, we can also handle functions that are not analytic, that have a discontinuity or similar. Be really brutal. Let's just add more zeros here. I should really write a function for that. This gets tedious very quickly.
Yes.
Okay, don't do that at home. If you do that in your homework, you're not graded, but I subtract points for that. 10 to minus 9. Oh man, there's still not floating point round off. Yeah, no. So if you want to get a high accuracy, don't use a second order method. Use a fourth order method or use a spectral method. Okay. Do you have further questions so far? Complaints? Okay. You can also mention your complaints in private. Okay. Then next week on Monday, I'm going to talk about differential equations, boundary conditions, etc. And next week on Wednesday, there's going to be a lab session as well. And today we are not constrained because there's no colloquium. So if you want, you can stick around. We can continue a bit longer. I don't think that'll be possible next week.